Welcome to Packet Pushers, a podcast on the data networking industry where real engineers get together to talk nerdy about networking. Today, the virtual boardroom has been relocated to a safe house nearby to the data center with barred windows, armored doors, and guards on the front desk so that we can talk with Palo Alto Networks about the secrets of their next generation firewalls. Excited? Of course you are. When real engineers get together to talk nerdy, we don't have to apologize for talk technical, for waving our hands at the virtual whiteboard, or using cryptic TLAs and ETLAs to rapidly drill into deep technical problems. Today's show is sponsored by Palo Alto Networks and the Packet Pushers. Thank them for joining us to talk about their next generation firewalls. But before I introduce them, welcome Mr. Banks. How are you today, sir?
Doing tremendously well. Very happy to be here. Now, Palo Alto Networks has been on my radar for quite a while. I'm in a situation right now where I'm looking ahead to what the next bit of security is going to look like in one of the networks that I support. And because Palo Alto Networks is doing things differently with the next generation solution, I've been wanting to hear this for quite a while. So I'm rather keen to get this conversation rolling.
And I also, so I do a lot of security design and security architecture, and I'm interested to get the details from our guests today. First of all, introducing Danelle Au. Danelle, tell other people a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Greg. Hi, Ethan. My name is Danelle Au. I actually work on security solutions at Palo Alto Networks, so bringing our great next generation firewall technology that you're going to hear about today to various IT initiatives from data center to mobility, BYOD, internet gateway deployments.
Outstanding. Thank you very much for joining us today. And also with us is Nick Campana. How are you today?
Doing great. Thank you, Greg. Just want to say thank you so much for the opportunity to join you on Packet Pushers. So within Palo Alto Networks, I'm part of the product management organization. My specific group is focused on the core technologies. This is the user ID, application identification, as well as the general firewall operating system.
We've got an agenda that we want to run down here today to sort of share to people a little bit about the Palo Alto Network products and how they fit and what's unique about them. So why don't we kick off with the primary point about Palo Alto Networks, which is the next generation firewall. What is it about next generation firewalls that is making the market say this is what we want? What's different about those compared to just, say, a firewall?
Over the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of changes from applications, users, and content perspective. So in the past, security used to be an afterthought. If you remember, it was a compliance checklist after you designed everything else. Now it's top of mind. It's a board-level conversation for a number of reasons. Number one, definitely from an attack perspective, the attacks to the enterprise has changed. Users have changed. They're now accessing the network via a variety of different access types and devices. And more importantly, applications have also changed. There's been a proliferation of applications, both personal and business. And a lot of these applications use non-standard ports. They port hop, or they use encryption to simplify and streamline user access. When you look at traditional security solutions, they're based on a lot of very static attributes, like you identify the traffic based on ports or protocols, or you identify user based on IP address. A lot of times, it's cobbling together a variety of different threat prevention technologies. I need to deal with exploits. Let me throw an IPS in there. I need to deal with viruses. Let me throw an AV in there. The reason why the market is moving towards next generation firewalls is just that there needs to be a new way to solve this problem, where you're not relying on ports and protocol to identify traffic. You can actually set a security policy that enables specific users and groups of users instead of just IP addresses, and where you can be able to tackle threats via a complete threat framework, the whole attack lifecycle, and not just piecing together or cobbling together different pieces of technologies, different firewall helpers, if you will.
Yeah, the old concept of a stateful firewall is overly simplistic in this era, where allowing in TCP port X or IP address Y, when our applications are actually far more sophisticated. They don't just use one port, or, you know, or just even allowing everything on port 80. Well, what's inside of that port 80? Well, it's HTTP. Well, is it? Is it really just port 80, or is it something else? And that's what we're more talking about with an application firewall. So maybe that's a good point for us to drill into. What are the fundamental differences between a next generation firewall and the stateful inspection firewall?
at a fundamental level, stateful inspection firewall is very effective at blocking or permitting access through various TCP ports, different UDP sessions. That's not a problem for a stateful inspection firewall. But as you mentioned, the applications have really changed in a massive way. We've seen this shift from port 80 representing simple static web content, if you go back far enough in time, to now we have applications ranging far from being legitimate business applications, something like Salesforce, which operates over 443. We also see more risky applications like BitTorrents, like UltraSurf, which is actually used to bypass your traditional security infrastructure. Applications like this are able to try different ports to look for openings in the firewall. They're able to use proprietary encryption technologies to bypass deeper inspection engines in many cases. So there's been this movement towards a next-generation firewall in order to address the whole gamut of different types of threats.
I found something in my network recently where somebody had allowed SSL through HTTP 443, and they were actually not running encrypted HTTP. They were running an SSL VPN through the firewall and exfiltrating data through that. I mean, and that's the classic thing, is it's not just enough to say this is TCP 443, which is SSL. There are many types of SSLs used for everything these days. It can be JSON, it can be web traffic, it can be SSL VPNs, it can be all sorts of stuff. And that's what this application awareness is what we're really drilling into at a headline level.
Now, Palo Alto Networks has a feature here. The big thing I saw reading through all the literature is App ID, which goes after this issue of applications that can masquerade as other things if you only look at it at a port level. So why don't you explain how App ID works?
So App ID begins with an application signature check. Within that application signature, what we're looking for are various application properties and transactional characteristics. From there, we typically proceed to protocol decoding. So PAN-OS actually supports over 150 different major protocols and applications. Here we do some basic protocol validation. We can identify tunneled applications. So for example, web browsing is the App ID that we use for typical web traffic before we look any deeper. Upon further inspection, we can identify applications within that at various levels. So for example, we can see Gmail at first glance. And within Gmail, we can actually identify and enable or block certain functions within Gmail. Google Chat is a prime example. So you have Google Chat.
Annoy all the people. Take away their fun.
Absolutely. So it's all about providing the security team the opportunity to safely enable these different communication mechanisms. So we're not about blocking applications and blocking functions. We're actually about allowing their use, but scanning the content to make sure that intellectual property is not being exfiltrated, as you mentioned before, over the SSL VPN. And we're looking for threats coming into the network. With the way modern threats have evolved, if you can't decrypt SSL and look deep inside that traffic, identifying files, looking for exploits of various applications, then you're going to have trouble keeping endpoints and devices within your network secured.
So that's actually a great question. How are you handling encrypted traffic streams?
Palo Alto Networks' next generation firewall has two basic approaches to encrypted streams for SSL. The first is for what we call inbound inspection. So if you're securing traffic to a web browser that resides inside your data center, what we can actually do is load the private key onto the firewall, and then the firewall is able to inspect all the traffic starting from the handshake that goes between a client that's outside your network to the server that's inside your data center. Basically, we can use all of our security functionality. We can identify applications and ensure that only the right set of apps is running for that server. We can provide threat prevention. So with threat prevention, we have a number of different capabilities. These include antivirus, anti-spyware, IPS, which is more important in this example, as well as our new WildFire technology. all of these security capabilities are enabled for traffic that runs over SSL. So I'd mentioned that there are two use cases. Inbound inspection is the first for protecting your server. And the second use case is to secure traffic from clients inside your network going out to an arbitrary host on the internet. So this we actually call SSL forward proxy. And it works by acting much like a man in the middle. We can load a trusted certificate authority onto the firewall. And what happens is the client connection actually terminates on the firewall, and the firewall reaches out towards the server. On that end of the connection, we can determine whether the server is trusted based on the signing CA, based on revocation information within the certificate. If it is a trusted server, we will make a copy of the server cert. We'll sign it with our internal trusted certificate authority on the firewall, and then we'll present that certificate to the client. The other scenario is where a server is not trusted out on the internet. We'll actually use an untrusted CA certificate to sign those.
I'm just going to diverge a little bit here and say, as somebody who works in Europe, the use of forward proxies is very, very common, because that allows all outbound traffic to be inspected, because the process of the browser connects to the firewall, which terminates the SSL, can inspect all of the traffic going in and out, and then the firewall makes the request on my behalf. I call that the it's your round in the bar principle, right? I give my mate 10 quid and he goes off to the bar and buys beer for me and brings them back. I trust him to take my 10 quid and give me beer in exchange. That's how I explain it to executives.
I love that analogy.
That's how I explain forward proxies to people. The firewall does all the queries, but it's that because you do that SSL termination, you can see the payload that's inside, and that's how you can protect the internal hosts. And because of that termination, you're able to see what's actually happening. Now, I guess this leads into a question where, because you could now see what's going on, you can start to do things like, what's the difference between a SharePoint blog and SharePoint administration?
Yeah, exactly. What Nick talked about earlier is we offer what we call safe application enablement. So instead of just allowing and blocking, we let users and organizations strike a balance with firewall policies. So for example, specific application functions, you may want to allow for certain groups of users. SharePoint block, you may want to allow for your marketing users, but SharePoint administration, that's something you want to reserve and lock down and allow only for your specific IT admins. So we can do that within our security policies.
Does that integrate with user authentication?
Yes. So it integrates with our user ID capabilities. And the way user ID works is the end user would log into a directory system. It could be eDirectory, Active Directory, LDAP. And that IP address to user mapping is going to be tracked via user agent that provides that information to our firewall. It's completely transparent to the users. We're not going to make particular organization recreate an entire identity repository just to work with us, right? We will work with whatever is existing within that organization. Based on that IP address to user mapping, we can then identify who that user is, and that security policy then can be enforced. So in our security policy, you'll see you can actually tie it to the user and user groups. There are no IP addresses in that security policy.
We're not basing it on source IP address there. What you're actually saying is the SharePoint hits, the Palo Alto uses the App ID functionality to detect that that's a SharePoint admin, and then directs the authentication request away to the Active Directory server, say, for example, and challenges the username that's actually in the web authentication process transparently. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then the SharePoint administrator can then go through the firewall to the rule, because he is a valid SharePoint administrator in the Active Directory group. He's got a permission in the Active Directory group to go through.
That's correct. So if you hire a new admin, as long as you put this new admin in the right category in Active Directory, you know, or whatever identity repository you use, then that same security policy is going to be enforced.
That's pretty
sweet. So you had mentioned a user agent. Is there a user agent component that goes along with this as well?
We actually have two types of user agents. We have both a more traditional user ID agent where you map one IP address to one user. We also offer a terminal services agent where you have multiple users tied to the same IP address. And for that, we look at also the port ranges to determine who the user is. And then for user identities that cannot be determined via any of these repositories or the authentication mechanisms, we have a browser challenge, a captive portal. We also have an API that can tap into repositories that already exist. For example, if someone was using 802.1x for wireless authentication and that existed, we can tap into that and gather that information as well.
Gotcha.
So one thing that I would add to that, if I may, the actual agent capability has two deployment options. One is to actually run on a Windows machine. It doesn't have to run on a domain controller. It doesn't run on the end user's machine, but it can run on any machine that has access to the domain controllers to be able to read security logs and to also be able to read Exchange server logs. So, for example, if you have a device like a Mac laptop, we're actually able to provide user to IP mappings even if you're not authenticating to the domain. And this is done by basically accessing your Exchange logs and looking for a correlation between a username and an IP address. So then the second deployment option, which we internally refer to as agentless user ID, allows you to run all of the agent functions on the firewall itself. And in this case, it will run on the management plane of the firewall and basically provide all the same capabilities that are provided by the Windows-based user ID agent.
So you put all these pieces together, you end up with a very fine-tuned control over what people can access, and then not just what they can access, what they can do when they get there. And so there's quite a comprehensive policy that's really happening high. It's happening at layer 7. So just to follow up on the introduction here to this product, whereas many firewalls are simply, it's doing stateful inspection, doesn't get much smarter than port level for a lot of basic firewalls. You've gone way beyond this here and provided functionality that gets to where users are and the applications that they're using, and IP addresses and port numbers are really incidental.
Ethan, that's absolutely correct. Part of the beauty of this solution is if you actually look at how the device is configured. So we talked about a lot of different inputs that go into your ultimate security posture. Applications, functions within applications. We also talked about threat prevention with IPS and antivirus and anti-spyware. And we talked about providing all of these different types of security on a per-user basis or on a per-group basis. All of these different functions are brought together in a single security policy. So you don't have one section up front with a stateful inspection policy, followed by an application-based policy, followed by an IPS policy. Instead, you just have one row in the security rule base that specifies which users should be allowed to access which applications or functions, and how would you like to secure that traffic. All in just one place, and it's very easy to understand at a glance.
And the most exciting part about that is that your users actually come from, the user database comes from Active Directory.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we can pull in the user to IP mappings from many sources. Mm-hmm. And in constructing your security policy, we also pull in user to group mappings. Mm. So right there in the firewall's interface, you can choose a group within AD, you can choose a specific user, all without having to create any kind of custom LDAP queries to be able to pull in that information on a per policy basis.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners might be intrusion prevention system fans, but it sounds like the Palo Alto Networks approach is you don't need a separate standalone IPS. How would you convince someone who's maybe an IPS fan or has IPS deployed in their company that this is a one box fits all of those, answers all of those security concerns?
So IPS is a very important part of the puzzle. There's no denying that. It's very important to be able to provide that upfront exploit protection for servers and for clients as well. The problem is that threat prevention now focuses on a number of different exploitation techniques to be able to get into the enterprise. So it has to be a multifaceted approach that looks at more than just that IPS. And it's very important to have context between these different security functions. So just to add a little bit of color to what I'm talking about, so if you look at a modern threat exploit, It might start by baiting an end user. This could happen through a social network, through an email that entices a user to access a particular application or a particular website. At the very front of your security policy, if you're creating policy based on App ID and blocking high-risk applications that are typically used for these type of exploits, you're already reducing the attack surface. And next step is URL filtering, so we can block known malware sites. So if this is a particular type of baiting or phishing that's been used in the past or that we've detected through our WildFire system, we can actually push those URL categorizations into our URL filtering database and, again, provide some protection on the front end. The next step is the actual delivery of an exploit to an end user system, which is where the IPS technology comes in. And, of course, we do focus very heavily on that feature set as well because of the importance of blocking those exploits. Once the exploit is delivered, assuming it's a zero-day exploit that nobody has seen before, signature protection doesn't actually help. So the next step is actually the exploit will come in and download a backdoor. We might see this through our antivirus technology where we'll block the malware. We also have drive-by download protection that's a part of our file blocking profiles. And then the sort of the last step in security on this front is detecting unknown malware. So with our WildFire system, we can send these payloads that come in through a backdoor up to our WildFire cloud service, run that application, and actually look for over 100 different behaviors or characteristics of that file to identify it as a malicious file. Finally, we'll automatically generate a signature and push that down through our AV updates. Really, there are a lot of different pieces that go into security and threat prevention these days. So looking at IPS alone is very limited in what it can do.
Just to add to what Nick said, I think one of the key differentiations with our solution is that because we start off with App ID, where we identify all traffic regardless of ports of protocol, we can see the threats that come in on non-standard ports. The foundation of our IPS and our threat prevention framework starts with application identification. So this means that you get the protection across all ports all of the time, even when there are threats that tunnel through non-standard ports.
What's the impact to hardware on this? My brain's going, okay, right now I have an infrastructure that's got firewalling services and typically encryption services and IPS inspection services all offloaded on separate box because they're separate functions. What's your box architecture that can handle all this stuff?
I think you hit right on the Achilles heel of a lot of modern security solutions. You have to compromise performance in order to have security. With our boxes, we've actually designed the architecture from the ground up to be able to provide all of these different security functions without having that major impact that causes you to have to scale out to many different boxes or to use a separate set of devices in this type of approach. So our architecture, starting on the data plane where all this security processing takes place, is a distributed multi-CPU architecture for all the security-focused features that actually leverages a custom-built hardware solution to basically act as a coprocessor to speed up the pattern matching and identification of threats, various applications, and of course, different types of security concerns.
So that's pretty important right there. This isn't just an x86 box with a ton of cores in it. This is actually an x86 box with a ton of cores in it, plus some kind of a custom ASIC that it was just built for Palo Alto Networks.
We do have x86 on the management plane because those are very efficient at management functions. And yes, on the data plane, we do not have any x86 processors. We use security chips specifically that have acceleration for things like crypto and decompression to be able to identify threats and applications within those streams. And yes, we do have custom hardware to speed the pattern matching capabilities. All of our different types of signatures, whether it's the application signatures I mentioned at the beginning, or if it's AV, anti-spyware, IPS, all of those are compiled in such a way that we can scan for everything in just one pass. This isn't like your typical UTM approach where your packet is sent first through the stateful inspection engine. then it's passed through an IPS engine, then it's passed through an AV engine, which is what we refer to as the sheet metal integration approach. Basically, you're consolidating power supplies, but all the security functions do actually end up operating separately on those devices.
Yeah, you got me excited when you said custom silicon.
Let's assume that we're convinced that all these features are things that I want. We've got the performance that we needed, because a lot of us get a bit bent out of shape about, you know, we need to have enough firewall performance to handle all of this. Let's talk about some fundamentals here. When we deploy a Palo Alto Networks next generation firewall, networking capabilities, when I put it in my network, what sort of modes can I get this in? What sort of networking features do I have in that chassis?
So from a networking standpoint, because we do have this custom homegrown architecture, we were able to take things into consideration, like networking capabilities, and of course, all of the content inspection acceleration. So in terms of networking, we have a number of different deployment options. One that we most typically see used when people are evaluating our product is called tap mode, where you can hook a single port on the firewall up to a tap port or a span port on the network, and just provide visibility into applications and threats that are seen on the network. The next deployment option, I'm going to kind of move up the networking stack.
Tap mode is important because, and it's not always obvious to people why tap mode is important until you start using it, which is you can put a firewall like this in place. It's like an IPS where you put it in line and then all of a sudden you realize that it's blaking things left, right, and center. And really what you need to do is spend some time looking at what's going past so that you can actually say, these are the things I need to identify. I need to work out what this is. I need to find it. What is that? This is being reported as malware, but it's my best application in my company. Tap modes are valuable for being able to deploy this into an existing system. Is that correct?
Tap mode is absolutely valuable in providing that kind of visibility. It might help you if you're evaluating the product to then see what applications are really flowing past my stateful inspection firewall, my IPS, etc. In practice, though, all of our customers actually deploy the firewall in such a way that it's either in line in a transparent mode or actually performing routing or switching functions.
Okay.
Because once they see the set of applications that are made visible during the evaluation process, it becomes imperative that they're able to either secure or in some cases block applications altogether if it's something that's very much malicious in nature.
Okay, so you said there that we can have the firewall in layer 3 mode. So typically, you know, outside subnet, inside subnet, run it through. You've also got...
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you've said switching mode, so layer 2. So it looks like a bridge port, and you can trigger, you know, run it up like it's a switch if you want to do that, if you're that way inclined. And then you said virtual wire. That's new to me. Explain that to me.
The way I always like to visualize virtual wire is just take a look at a network cable. If you were to be able to take a network cable that runs between your core switch and your core router and cut that thing in half and just stick a firewall in between, that's about the level of impact it would have on your topology. The firewall does not have a MAC address or an IP address. It's simply in line. It's able to see, block, decrypt, provide all the same capabilities as in layer 3, except that there's zero change to your logical network topology. It can be inserted really anywhere where there's a bottleneck in the network where all traffic will pass in both directions through this particular firewall.
We'll talk about HA in a second. So routing, do you support routing protocols on the box?
We call it routing here.
Let's not go there. You'll lose
the argument.
Yes, we
support routing.
I live where the Queen's English is spoken. Thank you very much.
So in terms of routing protocols, we support most of the typical protocols you'd see on a firewall, which are BGP for those deployments where we might be speaking directly to an ISP on the edge of the network, or IBGP inside the network. We support OSPF, which is one of the more common protocols that we see running on the firewall, given that it's typically internal. But we also support RIP and some of the multicast protocols like PIM sparse mode and PIM source specific multicast.
Okay. High availability, which is the last thing I want to talk about with this, because firewalls always have to happen at least in pairs, if not in more.
In fact, I like to see, assuming that the resources of the enterprise permit it, I like to see redundant paths through the network across all types of devices. Mm. A full mesh between a pair of HA devices and routers up above is a wonderful thing in terms of resiliency of the design. So for HA features, we support both active-passive, which is a very typical deployment that we use, where if there is a failover, all of your sessions are synchronized, your tunnels, tunnel security associations are synchronized. So if there's a failover, all of your sessions continue to flow, and the firewall will simply use a gratuitous ARP to update its network neighbors, basically to reestablish that path.
Yeah.
The other option is active-active, which was specifically designed to handle asymmetric routing in the network. So if you've got two different paths, either due to ECMP or possibly due to another form of load sharing of links, we can have one firewall in virtual wire or in layer 3 on one path and the other firewall on the other path. And for many stateful inspection firewalls, this is going to be a problem because they're not going to have state on both of those devices. Hmm. So what we'll actually do, in order to provide our full layer 7 capabilities in this environment, is use a cross connect to forward packets between the devices when a packet traverses the odd path. So for example, if the left side really owns that session and has all the layer 7 state, then if a packet traverses the right side, it will be passed across for layer 7 scanning.
Cool. You synchronize the data between the database or the state database between the two devices for an active-active mode, and it doesn't matter where it goes; it'll be able to pass through the firewall because the state's replicated. That's comprehensive. So you've solved all of the networking problems. The second thing, of course, is, as many people know, on a packet pushes, I'm big on virtualized firewalls. I think it's the future. Now, while I'm excited about custom silicon for performance, what sort of form factors does the Palo Alto networks come in?
So we do have a wide range at this point, from the lowest end box, which is a PA200 typically used in a branch office or maybe a small a retail type of deployment. And this box, it's a small desktop unit, four ports. It's 100 megabits per second firewall throughput with App ID enabled and 50 megabit per second threat prevention throughput. All the way up to the high end, the PA5060, which is a 20 gig firewall with App ID enabled and a 10 gig threat prevention throughput. This one has 10 gig ports and a broad set of 1 gig ports across copper and fiber. And of course, the last option is the VM series, which is a software only firewall that can run as a guest on ESX. I always struggle with the word guest versus host because they mean different things.
They do. Well, guest is what they used in the early versions of the documentation, and I still think of them as guests, and I keep getting spanked by the VM administrators who want to call them something else. Whatever. They can get over it. I guess one thing that I wanted to come back on, and I have actually saved this question for a little bit, is the user interface. What do we as network administrators get to see? We've got all of these complex functions, you know, the user identity, the application inspection, you know, we've got the IPS functions are based around content ID. We've got the wildfire malware protection. You can't configure that at a CLI easily. So what does management look like? What are the opportunities for managing the device and the centralized management?
So there are a broad set of capabilities both on the device itself and on Panorama, which is our central manager. Actually, quite a few users, even those previously CLI junkies, management solutions, really jump into our web interface for tasks like setting up your security policy, where we can pull in all of the user-to-group mappings. We have a full list of applications and application filters. It's a very simple web interface that gives you a table view into all the different policies, very straightforward. And as I mentioned before, all these different security capabilities are integrated into just that one security policy. There's just one row that represents all the traffic based on user, application, and various levels of scanning. So this is one option. Another option is, of course, the CLI, which is also comprehensive and provides you full access to the configuration on the device. We also have Panorama, the central management solution, which was designed to actually be part of the PanOS code base. So you actually will not have a learning curve moving from managing a single device to managing a full set of devices. The UI looks exactly the same in either case.
And we should add also that it's the same management platform, whether it's a hardware firewall or a virtual firewall. We're not going to make you relearn or use a new tool just for the virtualized firewalls.
Absolutely.
All right.
And another option is the XML, the REST-based API, which lets you run all sorts of operational commands, lets you configure the device. In fact, we've even had some customers on our dev center go so far as to build a portal front end to run various management tasks on the firewall through this XML API. It's very extensive. It allows you to do just about everything you can do in the web interface, but you can automate it, you can script it, you can have a lot of fun with it.
So there's a certain amount of power there to be able to automate your platform or to link your platform up to an automation system of some sort.
Absolutely. And this really comes to shine in the data center environment, especially now that virtual machines are orchestrated in a nearly real-time fashion. Instances are spun up or systems move. And we wanted to be able to build our product in such a way that you can allow your security policy and your security posture to keep pace with the speed at which the server team is working and deploying new services for the business unit itself.
Well, there's a hook here into software-defined networking. There's a partnership you folks have established with Big Switch Networks, for example. So I'm assuming that there's a play there to automate some of what's going on in your data center if you're using a Palo Alto Networks platform.
Yeah, we have integration with Big Switch. We have integration with Arista, who was recently on one of your podcasts as well, with various partners in the SDN space. And I think one of the unique features that we offer, dynamic address objects, allows us to be very flexible in being able to track virtual machine movement and also being able to fit it within an SDN architecture.
Yeah, in terms of those dynamic address objects, this is a really cool functionality that we happened upon in speaking with our customers. So we'd heard a number of times that a server team can bring up a new web server or a new database server in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, really whatever time it takes to spin up another OVF template. Really simple operation, doesn't take long. The problem that we'd seen in the security teams is that they're typically so overloaded that it might take them 2 or 3 weeks to be able to get into the firewall, to actually have an open window where they can make configuration changes and to update the policy to let this new instance or this new virtual machine communicate with the outside world or with other data center resources. So what a dynamic address object does is it's basically a reference in your security policy that can be updated in real time as you deploy new virtual machines. So for example, I could create a policy that says it's okay for all web servers to speak to a subset of database servers. For example, if you have some type of web application. And then if a new web server has to be spun up to respond to demand, we can push in real time with our XML API and update based on a simple tag what new web servers have been added into the data center. So this takes the response time from 2 to 3 weeks to actually, well, basically zero time if you have it built into your orchestration system.
So one question worth asking that I don't think we got into yet, because we were talking about management and Panorama, but we didn't really get into how you actually get visibility into all the data. Reporting and logging and this kind of stuff. I'm assuming there's a component there that handles that.
Yes, absolutely. So we have a feature within the product integrated into the UI called the Application Command Center. You can think of Applications Command Center as a sort of a heads-up, real-time view into what's happening in the network. So you're going to see information on the top applications that are being used right now. You're going to see what types of URL filtering categories are available and currently in use. You're also going to see a summary of all the different types of threats that are currently being detected and blocked by the firewall. This information by itself is okay. It's useful just to give you an idea of what's actually happening on the network. But the real power of ACC is actually correlating these different pieces of data together. So for example, if I'm on the ACC, I can look at the set of applications that are running and see how many different threats were transmitted through that application. So I can click on something like web browsing, which I on my system here, I can see that there were 25,000 threats detected, which means, of course, there's quite a bit of malicious traffic going through there. So now my view is filtered such that I'm only looking at web browsing traffic. And then I can see a set of which users are starting the most sessions of web browsing. We can see which source and destination countries. But what I find really interesting is the correlation between application and threat. So I can drill in further on threat as another dimension. Now I'm looking at web browsing, but I'm also looking at a particular threat that was discovered. And in this level of detail, I can see that one particular user hit this particular threat. I'm looking at an Apache memory allocation denial of service vulnerability. They hit that threat 23,000 times. In this case, I don't know what that particular threat means, but a lot of times you can use this information for threat remediation. You might use it to detect a botnet that's operating on your network. It's a very easy way to correlate applications, the threats that use that application as a vector, and which specific users, down to the username, have actually been exploited in that way.
And that's important because doing that on a traditional firewall means mining logs. You actually have to collect logs in some way, and then you actually have to correlate all those logs using some tool that's probably not optimized for security or firewall analysis. And that's what this brings to the table.
Yeah, and with ACC, in this example, I actually only had to click two times with my mouse to get to that level of detail. It's this sort of pivoting or correlation between different data sets that's really powerful, as well as the user interface that ties it all together.
So let's say that you're sitting in front of a customer and you've gone through this presentation of the Palo Alto Networks approach to firewalling and security. What's the one killer feature, if you had to pick one thing that you would say really brings it home and demonstrates the value of the platform?
I think our most unique feature definitely is a wildfire feature. So when you look at the evolution of threats, you've got the known threats that will hit the honeypots out in the wild. And for those, we've got the signatures to address those types of threats. But what we're increasingly seeing with attacks to a variety of different enterprises are these targeted zero-day customized APTs, if you will. What Wildfire offers is the ability to be able to execute and analyze these unknown files that could potentially have malware in a safe cloud-based virtual environment. And so this gives us the opportunity to observe the behavior to see if this is indeed malware, let the malware be executed the way the attacker intended it to do. And once we look at all these different behaviors, we can then create signatures you can use to prevent against the specific malware. The unique factor is that we're not just doing the analysis and doing the analysis of the malware, but because we are a firewall, we sit in the right place in the network, we can actually enforce the policy appropriately and be able to block those unknown attacks, unknown malware as they come into the network. So I think that's really unique because it's just such a top of mind problem for organizations today, this whole APT problem. And what we allow is the flexibility to be able to deliver it either execute this either within our cloud or within a private cloud on an appliance that the customer can deploy. And we offer the ability to actually do the enforcement on our firewalls.
Very good. Well, I think that really covers the basics of your platform pretty thoroughly. I have a much better idea of how Palo Alto Networks fits into things. Now, Danilo, before we started the call, you had mentioned that there was a you wanted to engage the Packet Pushers audience with something special, right?
Absolutely. We're really excited to be on this call today, and we've been following you guys for a while. So what we wanted to offer to your listeners is an AVR report. This is an application visibility report. What they would do is they would place our firewalls in their network so they can get visibility into the applications, the threats, what's actually happening in their network. So they can request for an AVR at www.paltonetworks.com/packetpushers, one word. And the first five people who complete an AVR will actually get a free PA200, which is the suite desktop next generation firewall. And we will also throw in licenses on that PA200 for 1 year.
That's cool. That's very cool. So people can get along and see you at your website at www.paloaltonetworks.com/packetpushers and sign up to get that, and then use the tap mode that we talked about earlier to get visibility into their applications. So they can actually do that, plug the firewall into their existing firewall in tap mode and see what's going on and start using the tool and see what it could do for them.
That's right.
And find out all the scary things going on that you didn't know were going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe you don't want to do that then. Maybe because you might now have several weekends of work to get this. Once you know it's a problem. Well, I think that's just about it for the show this week. I'd like to thank Danelle Au and Nick Campagna from Palo Alto Networks for joining us today and to talk about the next generation firewall product from Palo Alto Networks, because Ethan, this is quite unique. This is our first security product that we've talked about on the Packet Pushers as a sponsored show.
It is, and for the kind of content that we talk about, you know, leading edge stuff, doing new things with data centers, fitting into the virtualized space, software defined networking, this is a strong player. Palo Alto Networks fits right into that scheme. Forward thinking, it just fits. It's the right thing. Now I'm understanding what all the fuss was about and kicking myself in the head for why haven't I been digging through their website deeper sooner. But anyway, at least I got there now.
Can I say I told you so?
You can.
I told you so.
There you go.
I feel better. I'm not going to make a big thing out of it, but yeah, I told you so. Okay. Well, that's a wrap for the show this week, and thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. We should be back again in about a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Danelle for coming on the show this week. Danelle, tell people where they can find you.
They can find me on Twitter at Danelle Au, DanelleAu, and Palo Alto Networks is also on Twitter. It's at Palo Alto NTWKS.
Your name's too long for the Twitter handle, and that's why it's got the funny spelling. Thank you so much for organizing that special deal for the people who listen to the show. If they're interested, remember, go and hit paloaltonetworks.com/packetpushers, and you can get a hold of a free AVR. And sorry, if you go through the AVR, you may get a free firewall if you're one of the first five people. And thanks to Nick Campagna for joining us today. Where can people find you? Are you lurking around the Palo Alto campus this week?
Yes, Greg, you can find me at Palo Alto Networks headquarters in Santa Clara.
Not Palo Alto. Thanks so much for having us.
No problem. Well, Mr. Banks, thank you for joining me again.
Yep, good to be here as always. You can follow me on Twitter at ECBanks, on my blog, EthanCBanks.com, on networkcomputing.com. I also have a blog where I write for fun and profit, and I'd appreciate it if all of you all would follow me.
And of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. I'm also on the Twitter as at etherealmind. I'm on the Facebook with my own page and also on the Google Plus, all that good stuff. We would love to hear your feedback about today's show. So send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you are thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net, leave comments on today's show notes, or follow us on the Twitter as at packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.